things you've been recognized for as far as, you know, during your service. Just kind of generalities there.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we should begin at the beginning. I'm Soren Jessen. Grew up in eastern Montana on the Crow Reservation. And I enlisted in June 6th of 2001, prior to the great world change that was 9/11, right? And so September 11th happened when I was in AIT in 2001. And because I was down at Fort Huachuca going to school for electronics, intelligence, non-communications, I was in 98 Juliet, people were really worried about what this meant for the future of the Army and the future of foreign policy. I remember Sergeant Wheezy back in 2001. He said, you know, there isn't a person on this base that doesn't know somebody that works at the Pentagon. And so it was sort of a big deal. And you get different perspectives from people who have enlisted at various points in time. But, I mean, you could see the military and you could see the civilian population at this time physically change, I think, in some very real ways. I mean, I remember the day of, right? They locked everybody down. There was no classes for 2 days. And for the rest of the month, from September through most of October, they had privates running around in Kevlar pulling security detail on the base. It was interesting to be part of that, in that controlled sort of TRADOC environment where the regulations are strict anyway. Anyway, so when it comes to my service after AIT, I went to jump school, and after jump school, I went to Fort Gordon, Georgia. I was with the 513th Military Intelligence Battalion, and I spent 2.5 years as part of the TESS, the Tactical Exploitation System, doing ELINT, which is Electronics Intelligence Non-Communications. Essentially, you're tracing radar signals back to their source and identifying SAM systems and anti-aircraft threats and tracing them and giving them to people higher. That's that job. And then I was in the MASINT shop, Measurement and Signatures Intelligence, for 1.5 years, looking at pictures and doing threat assessments. Terms of recognition, not much to say there. Did my job to the best of my ability. Ran a really good shop when we were deployed from 2002 to 2003, and did the best I could. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, sort of general, but...
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm just going to close this door. Cause...
Oh, okay. I apologize.
Oh, no, it's not your fault, man. I just want to be able to hear just you and those guys, you know?
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Sweet. So let's see what else we got here. So I know that the 513th has, I mean, it's been active in almost every...
Oh, you did some research.
Yeah, right? It's been active in like every deployment since Desert Storm, right?
Right.
And was that Operation Enduring Freedom?
Yeah, OEF rolling over directly into OEF, right?
Yeah.
I mean, OIF, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, got there. I got to the unit in January 4th of 2002. No, February 4th of 2002, right after jump school. And spent the first months there, 6 months there, training to go over, learning the electronic order of battle for Iraq as such and Iran, and sort of familiarizing myself with the requirements in terms of disseminating information and putting that out. And then in September of 2002, September 21st of 2002, deployed over to Kuwait in support of what was then OSW, Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch, which, if you remember, you know, anything about this shit, what happened was after the fall of the Iraq War in what? After the end of the first Iraq War, Saddam got really mad at the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north. And so in the middle 90s, under Clinton, they imposed a no-fly zone underneath, you know, to below the 32nd parallel in the south and above the 33rd parallel in the north. And they called these things Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch, respectively. And it was a way to contain someone who was seen as a threat to the region. And it goes in with part-by-part sanctions and all of this other stuff.
Yeah.
And so I deployed originally in support of that in September 2002. And then in March, as everybody knows, OSW became OIF, and everybody rolled north to Baghdad. So.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
So how,
more you could say about it.
Yeah. How would you say... So I know you were deployed to Camp Doha, right? Am I pronouncing that right?
Camp Doha, Kuwait.
And was it a culture shock for you at all? I mean, how different was it? I mean, as far as, you know, interacting, like what level of interaction did you have?
God, we only got to go off base once, right? Because in October of 2002, I want to say the middle to end of October, two Marines were killed on an island south of Kuwait. So they locked the base down for the entirety of the time that I was there. So we couldn't go off into Faha Hill. So I got to go to Kuwait City once. In terms of geography for an Eastern Montana boy, it's surprising how much Kuwait looks like South Dakota.
Really? Yeah,
that's
funny,
you know,
right?
Like, I mean, it does. Similarities, you know? Down to the point where every once in a while in the news, if you listen to the news in Great Falls or in Glasgow, they'll find camel spiders that are indigenous to Montana, right?
I had no idea.
Because it's an arid environment here in Montana,
yeah,
right? You cross that 98th meridian in Fargo and you're west of 15 inches of rain a year, right?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So, yeah, it's a small desert here in Montana.
Yeah.
You know?
That's cool.
So it's interesting. In terms of interactions with folks, at least at the time I was there, there was a large third country national population from India and Pakistan and from, you know, from Malaysia. And they were the cooks and...
Kind of behind the scenes
and picking up the trash and doing all of that type of stuff. And it's interesting to look at, you know, a society from that perspective, right? Because your average third country national is essentially locked in to a job. For most of his life, he can make enough money, more money in Kuwait than he can where he comes from. But the opportunities for economic advancement, for marriage, for all of the things that people take for granted in a quote-unquote middle-class society are sort of closed off. So in that respect, I mean, it was similar to, I thought at the time, it was similar to where I grew up on the reservation, because you have the difference being that in this case, the Kuwaiti nationals are the people with the most opportunities who are living on oil money, and the third country nationals are the ones with opportunity denied because of the legal structure of the country and things like that. But in terms of on base, how to say this? Military bases are little segments of America. I mean, they are. Let's be honest with this, you know? And while when you leave this environment, there's a culture shock. It really says something about the messianic vision of that is America, when you can go into the little PX on Camp Doha and you can get the same magazines that you read back in the States, or you can, you know, go to Hardee's, you know, because AFI's has AFI's, another agency fucking every soldier. Oh, excuse me. Army and Air Force Exchange Services is what it stands for. But anyway, because AFI's has a contract with Hardee's or with Burger King, and it says something about the not only the messianic vision of American capitalism, whatever that term means, but it also says something about the ways in which people bring with them to an environment their culture, and they try to recreate little snippets of home, no matter where they are, based on their experiences and their vision of, you know, America that's in their head. And it just so happens that this particular small little vision of America was bound up with late 20th century sort of brand culture. Anyway, yeah. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like the, whenever I think of the, you know, the corporate consolidation of like American culture, it's like the death of culture in my mind. You know, it's kind of,
I wouldn't call it the death of culture.
I guess not the death of, I guess the ambiguity of culture.
Well, yeah, you know, yeah, it's yeah, like yeah, the, yeah.
We're all stripped down of like who we are, where we come from, and we're all like replaced with an easier kind of consumerist.
But it's a process that has been happening in this country since the late 19th century.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
Late 19th, yeah. Early 20th century, you know?
I mean, even the first colonies started off as corporations. I mean, yeah, they were corporations.
Well, yeah, but no, I mean, in terms of the advent of a consumer culture, where does it date from? It dates from the imposition of the railroads, the establishment of a catalog, Sears and Roebuck catalog, and then later in the 20s, you know, this idea of a mass-produced sort of radio culture, you know,
united
that morphs into television, to
which is even
you
more
know,
intensive and, as far as the, you know, projecting what you perceive as normality.
And in 2002, 2003, where you're in the middle of what some people would call the internet revolution, but it hasn't taken off to the extent that it has now.
Yeah,
you know,
Facebook.
Everybody has a smartphone now, right? And you can check your Facebook page on your fucking smartphone, right?
Yeah, right. You're
but
wired.
In 2002, 2003, we didn't necessarily have all that. You had a cell phone.
Yeah, but no.
But no
internet.
No internet on your phone, right?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know. So. Yeah. So. But it's interesting because there are material cultural elements to deployment that are fascinating. Anyway.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Sorry, so. Yeah. Yeah, just always it always amazes me though, you know, like the McDonald's all over the world, you know, go anywhere in the world, get a Big Mac, you know, it's craziness sometimes.
Well, I mean, no, there's a story about that, right? That's directly related to deployment, my deployment, right? In late March, early April of 2003, the seersucker. That there was a missile that hit the Shark Mall in downtown Kuwait City, right? And the explosion woke me out of bed. So I woke out of bed, put on my gas mask, put on my J-list, right? And sat down to wait for the all clear, which is what you do, because we'd been spending 2 months in chemical gear, you know, because we were worried about Scuds and the alarms were going off, and you know, you had two Patriot missile batteries in Kuwait as such, maybe three. But anyway, so this explosion woke me out of bed. And when the missile came in, there's this pier in Kuwait City, right? And you have these boats and these yachts at the end of the Shark Mall, which is what we used to call it. And a missile came in, and it hit the water tower, and it landed right by the boats on the edges of the dock. And the backblast actually hit the Starbucks that was there in the mall in Kuwait City. And so... I mean, it's directly related that, you know, in the midst of this war, one of the casualties was Starbucks, you know, in downtown Kuwait City, right? That's which funny. Is something that we don't necessarily think about.
Yeah, that's
it's a funny little anecdote.
Yeah, it's definitely funny. It's like, yeah.
So.
It's craziness.
Anyway.
Cool, man. I mean, when all that was going on, you know, and you had to, you know, obviously on edge, worrying about chemical warfare, things like that. Right. Was there any, what'd you do to, I mean, keep calm or just keep, like, level, man? Was there, like, a book you read or a...
Well, we smoked.
Yeah.
Smoked like a chimney. I still smoke too much. But we were... There was very little downtime. We were working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. Because you had a shift change, you had a 12-hour shift, and a shift change that took an hour before your shift, and a shift change that took an hour after your shift. So that's 13 to 14 hours a day, sometimes longer. There was no downtime in the middle of all of this. Now, unlike the people that went north, you're in an office, right? But you're still in an office in your J list. Which is your MOP gear, your mission-oriented protective posture, your chemical gear, with your mask by your side. And if you're working on a product to send out to hire and the alarm goes off and you've got a deadline, then you put your mask on your face and you continue typing at a keyboard, which is a weird little juxtaposition where you see soldiers in, you know, chemical gear sitting, you know, because they don't necessarily always have time to go out to the bunker. Now, most of the time we went out to the bunker after the alarm went off and sat in the bunker and waited for the all clear. But I can remember twice during this whole experience when I was working on something rather important and I just stayed where I was and got the product out so it was out... And I met the deadline, which is interesting. But no, the only book I read while all of this was going on, at the time it was going on, was Leon Uris, Trinity. Picked it up in the Red Cross section of the bookstore. Now, after I read some other stuff in May, started my lifelong sort of acquaintance with classics. I picked up Aurelius, picked up the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. But while it was going on, the only thing that grabbed my interest for a couple hours every night was Eris, was Trinity. So it was a good book, but when it comes to that type of stuff, I've always been a reader. So anyway.
Yeah, excellent, man.
What else?
I mean, The Meditations, that's a heavy book for sure.
In May, it was right where I was at. Yeah. In May of 2003, you know, after going through all of this shit and we're cleaning up equipment and we're ready to go back, then here I am. And, yeah, so, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that, so what did you, I guess, to stay on that subject, when you got out on your service, what are you doing now? I mean, you're a grad student. What are you pursuing as far as your involvement with education? Are you going for classical literature?
Well, I did that as an undergrad. There were two parts to my degree. I was a history and classical studies major up at Carroll. And now I'm just trying to get the master's degree because the VA, like the Godfather, sort of made me an offer I couldn't refuse. They were like, well, you got a pretty good GPA when as an undergrad, and so if you go in state, we'll pay for you to go to grad school and get a master's degree. And I wasn't ready and I wasn't prepared for it, but I'm doing the best that I can as such. And right now I'm working on The History of a Single Day. I did my honors thesis at Carroll on the history of the sugar beet industry in Montana. So, yeah. But more about this other stuff, I guess.
Yeah, cool, man.
I mean, we should probably bring it back.
Yeah, bring it back for sure.
Yeah.
So, what was your view? I mean, obviously you're in it right as the major change came and kind of the American perception of like the war on terror and things like that. And that would have been a huge turning point there, obviously. So when you enlisted, what were your motivations and how did they change at all when that happened? Did it change your perception of it? And then compare that to, you know, when you finished your service, you know, had your viewpoint on the conflict changed at all through your work or through your interactions, you know, in that part of the country?
It's hard. It's hard when you're 18, 19 years old to sort of get a handle on things and to sort of understand what you should know. Can we take five?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
yeah.
come back and yeah, no answer worries, this
man.
Question.
Of course, baby. The change you saw, you know, post 9/11 when you came home, and just, you know, how did that impact you? You know, like, what was your opinion of that?
Well, at the time, I'm sorry to say, I couldn't find my ass with both hands in a compass. I was 18 years old. Coming home, and you know, in AIT, in this very structured environment, you realize the magnitude of what you're going through, but it doesn't really hit you in training how it affects the rest of the nation, even with the national lockdown and the, you know, the implication of ThreatCon Delta, you know, across the country and the command that no planes could fly. But when I came home in December of 2002, or 2001, sorry, December of 2001, I flew into Billings, you know, Logan International Airport in Billings. And up until this time, you'd always been able to meet people and see people as they get off the plane, right? I mean, it's a small town, so the plane would come in and taxi up and people would wave. And I fly into Billings expecting something like this to happen and not realizing that even in little Billings, Montana, that I would have to walk through a security checkpoint and, you know, meet my parents on the other side of the airport, and that something had drastically changed. And looking back on it now, in hindsight, it's rather easy to say that security theater has been detrimental to the interests of ordinary folks. But at the time, I mean, to put yourself in that position, what stands out the most is the fear. Everybody was afraid. And the administration, the Bush administration, then in power, and the media took up that fear and used that fear as a mobilization for the war effort. I remember in late May, early June of 2003, as we were getting ready to wind things down and we were having a conversation, and Ken Sizemore said, you know, overnight, the American media went 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, Al-Qaeda, 9/11, Al-Qaeda, 9/11, Al-Qaeda, 9/11, Saddam, and now we're in Iraq. And that always struck me as a rather cogent explanation for the evolution of the Iraq War as such and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Because for whatever it's worth, you can go back if you want and you can read the presidential debates between George W. Bush and Al Gore in 2000, where he provides the same justification regarding weapons of mass destruction and Saddam is a force for instability in the region that would become prevalent in 2002, 2003. And my suspicion and my fear, looking back on this now, having looked at it, is that George W. Bush wanted to do this, and 9/11 provided a justification and an opportunity in a very profound way for him to do something that he'd always wanted to do, which was depose Saddam and sort of avenge his father, I guess, if you want to put it in those sort of simplistic narrative terms. But I think there's some honest-to-God truth to that, that George W. Bush came in with a hard-on for Saddam Hussein, and that 9/11 provided the justification for the eventual invasion as like such.
His modern-day Reichstag in a way, almost, you know, except, you know, with other connotations of...
Well...
Yeah, it was that.
It was an opportunity.
Yeah.
It was an opportunity. Which he made the most of, I would say. But within that, you know, there have been some unintended consequences with the rise of the security state, the rise of security theater, with the, how to say this, the use of information And the idea that we should never let this happen again has become a justification for American paranoia and a justification for, I would say, in some ways, an anti-democratic spirit in the country when it comes to the civil rights and civil liberties. And it doesn't fix any of the major problems that led up to 9/11. It doesn't. It doesn't. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security, the growth in the intelligence bureaucracy has not the loosening of restrictions when it comes to wiretapping and things like that have not fundamentally fixed the problems that led up to 9/11, because those inherent structural problems of agencies refusing to talk to each other and these bureaucratic turf battles are still prevalent. I mean, but it is what it is, and we are living with the long-term consequences of our own pervasive fear, as it was, even though I would say that most people are no longer afraid. They have accepted a certain amount of inconvenience as such.
Yeah, and you think that, and do you think that's obviously detrimental, the normalization of the hyper security state, you know?
Yeah, and the normalization of the normalization of nationalist rhetoric and the normalization of this idea of American exceptionalism, which you can find, right? But I mean, it hasn't been a war that's been fought by the vast majority of the population. It's been a war that's been fought by a select group of people, right? You know, and it reminds me in some instances of the line from Kipling's Tommy, right? Where he says it's Tommy this and Tommy that, and throw him out the brute, but it's the savior of his country when the guns begin to shoot. And we see that. We see this overrepresentation of patriotism in this country, and this ethic of supporting the troops, which has been, in some cases, for the good, because my generation of veterans have benefited the most of any generations of veterans since World War II, and I'm living proof of that. But when it comes to the actual service, it's still less than 1% of the population that ever volunteers, that ever serves in the military as such. People going on multiple deployments,
Yeah, sort
you
of
know,
sequential tours and
sequential tours. I know people that when I was in were originally deployed in 2001, right after 9/11, to OEF, to Afghanistan, who were brought from Afghanistan to Camp Doha, Kuwait,
yeah, so it's
right?
like not
And
interim.
deployed for 2 years straight.
And
then came back and were stop lost on top of that. And all of those guys got out. But you see this. You see the stress of multiple deployments on soldiers and their families.
It's relentless.
And it's relentless. And it has to do with the dearth of people being willing to serve. I mean, you know, and Bush, in great fashion, similar to Hoover, right, declared a new normalcy after 9/11, right? That you should buy an SUV as a statement of patriotism. And there was very little rhetoric when it came to, you know, the question of who would bear the brunt of this and how Americans as a whole could contribute. You know, there was sort of this symbolic rhetoric of rallying around the flag, but there was very little that actually, you know,
action. Yeah.
When it came to all of this.
Yeah. More than a bumper sticker, you know. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great, man. Well, I think, you know, unless there's anything else you'd like to add.
What else do you want to ask about? What else do you want to know?
You know, I mean,
we didn't really touch on some things, so.
What things do you think we should touch on? I mean, like, that you feel we kind of skipped over.
I don't know. There's, I have no idea.
I mean,